You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
This is Bookworm. My name is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Mark Helprin. He's the author, most recently, of Memoir from Ant Proof Case, published by Harkett Brace. The previous book was A Soldier of the Great War. We hardly need to mention Winter's Tale, Swan Lake, Refiner's Fire, Ellis Island, A Dove of the East. The first time I met you, I believe in 1989, we spoke about Swan Lake as being a book for sad children.
Mm-hmm.
This too, Memoir from Ant Proof Case, is a book from and for a sad child, yes?
About a sad child, about a man whose childhood made him a case, so to speak, most bluntly.
I'm glad that you say this because I have regarded, although the narrator invites us to call him whatever we like, including Oscar Progresso or a set of other names, I regard him as Ant Proof Case.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I have to say that most people don't have the vaguest idea, I mean, not even the wooliest. They think that they say, what is this Ant Proof Case? What does it mean? Of course, there's an Ant Proof Case in the book. But in addition, obviously, he's the Ant Proof Case. The Ant Proof Case, who was not eaten by the ants, as were his parents after they were murdered, and this is what did to him what was done to him.
In fact, for me, the most touching exchange in the book is when he meets in the forest, in the jungle, an anteater.
Ah. I must say that sort of just happened by accident. That was one of those instances where the author is completely out of control and the book is writing itself and it just drags you along. Like in my hotel room, I'm on a book tour right now. I don't live in Los Angeles. I turned on the television, I was watching ESPN, and there's a new type of water skiing competition, which is they don't just jump over those horrible jumps that they jump on. They do it without skis. They do it just in their bare feet. And they don't just do it in their bare feet. They do it so that they invert and they flip along. It's not in the traditional water ski position. It's flat out because it gives them more distance. Well, that's what I felt like at that point. But it was a feeling of great pleasure and joy, really. Just at that point, the book completely took over. I was not in charge at that point.
But it does, you know, much of the book is about erosion and resisting erosion. Mm-hmm. If those vaults into which the hero and his consort break are seen as being breaking into a purportedly ant-proof case, they succeed, but no one breaks into the hero. He stands with his values.
That's right. That's right. And you know, it's funny because the Boston Globe did a couple of reviews of this book, and in one of the reviews, it was very unfortunate. The reviewer gave it a very good review. He loved it. He thought it was terrific, but he thought it was a screed against what he called the bankrupt sensibilities of European culture. Which is very funny. I mean, because if our culture had some of those bankrupt sensibilities, our culture would be less bankrupt. And as I would trade Beavis and Butthead for the Louvre, wouldn't you?
Is someone asking?
Yeah, no, unfortunately not.
We don't have a choice.
We don't have a choice. But the fact is that this guy, Oscar Progresso, or whatever his name was, of course that's not his name, it's an alias. Only I know his name, and like the shadow, I'm not telling. But he is one of the great resistors, and he is also moral. He's absolutely moral. But the some critics think that he's an immoral hero, like an anti-hero, but he's not. He's not an anti-hero. He's very carefully moral, and he very carefully digs his heels in and preserves that which he loves from the past. In fact, that's what his whole life is. His whole life is a devotion to the memory of his parents, somehow keeping them alive through his various obsessions.
Well, the great recognition that he has in the final pages of the book is that his impulse to protect the things and people he loves goes into even stronger service after their death. That's right. When they really need to be protected.
That's exactly the case. Well, I'm not going to compliment you, but how refreshing it is to talk to someone. Oh, that's absolutely the case. It's and that's what the if one could say what a book is about. You know, I frequently go on morning television shows and they say, well, "What's your book about?" And I get in terrible trouble. I've gotten in a lot of trouble with a woman in Cleveland whose claim to fame was that she interviewed Hitler. And she said she had in the 30s. She was Jewish. She went to Germany as a young journalist and interviewed Hitler. And she said, what is your book about? And I said, well, look, if I could say that in a couple of sentences, I wouldn't have written the book. I tried to make the book as economical as I possibly could. And it really takes... She said, oh, come on now. Come on. You know, she wanted to be tough. She said, come on, she said. Let's drop that crap. I mean, this is live television. She said, if you can't do that, what are you on this show for? And I said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, what are you out here flogging your book for? I said, well, I'm on this show because you invited me. So I took refuge in that. And she said, oh, come on. And I said, well, that's true. And as it happened, I think it was the first television show I ever did for a book. And then we got in an argument on camera, live, hot, as Marshall McLuhan would say, really hot. And then finally she turned to me and said, you know, young man, I have to tell you that you are the most difficult person I have ever interviewed, and that includes Adolf Hitler.
Well, to avoid the spectacle of a bookworm being tickled pink, I will reiterate that my guest is Mark Halperin, and the book is Memoir from Ant Proof Case. Now, when you were last here, you described this book as a dessert, and in fact, not as a challenging dessert. I asked you, like tapioca, a dessert that people don't frequently like, and you said, no, triple fudge chocolate, and said that it would be extremely compressed. Well, in the years that followed, the book has obviously grown, and I suspect...
No. It's only 500 pages, whereas the other one was twice that.
Oh, so this was short.
This is a short book. I mean, actually, in manuscript, Soldier of the Great War was 1,500 pages, and this one came out to something like 700 or something. So it's half the length, and it's much easier. It's almost like a short story. are contemporary novels not that long generally? I mean, this is a long book. I guess it's a kind of a average large book, I guess, because there are all these little miniature books around. You know, I go to a bookstore and I see that half the books that are for sale now are books that for Lilliputians, little teeny weeny books.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. From your previous description, I thought that you were writing a cuckoo clock. You know, something whose works were extremely complex, open to the eye, and delightful, that finally, at the end of the metaphorical hour of reading, a bird would pop out of a door and surprise me with a peck. And this is a much richer book than the kind of... In fact, we talked about the Coffee Cantata, the mm-hmm. Bach, and mm-hmm. you said that you were... like the Bach, writing something that was mad.
Oh, it is, of course.
It is
mad, but, you know, in the front, there's a quote from Hamlet, by in direction, find directions out. And it is mad, but it's just like Oscar Progresso, who is a criminal and a madman, but who at the same time ultimately defends all that is right and good. The book is mad, but there's method in the madness, and it does come together at the end. All the threads are united. Everything is explained. All the rivers run to the sea, and it has a really a classical structure, even if it's disguised as a postmodernist 20th century voiced type of novel.
Well, you told me that if A Soldier of the Great War was a symphony, or more specifically a mass, that Memoir for Man-Proof Case was a rondo.
Yes, that's true. And rondo is a very good word to describe. It's amazing to hear this. I don't remember. I remember vaguely. I remember about the cake and the fudge. But a rondo is a very good word for it because the structure is somewhat like a rondo. It's thematically repeated throughout the chapters, which are not exactly linked, and yet they are linked to the grand design. And it does come full circle at the end. And there is a kind of a lightheartedness about it, which Soldier of the Great War did not have. I thought, anyway, that it was very funny. So,
well, it veers in and out of being, you know, very funny, mm-hmm. and then at the same time, it's very sad. You know?
Yeah.
Because if the previous books could be called, as we were saying, books for hurt children, this is the first one being ostensibly written by a hurt child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And by the way, when you mentioned about veering in and out of being funny and sad, I'm reminded of a teacher that I had in college. His name was Frohawk. And everyone, this was in the 60s, at Harvard, everyone hated Frohawk because he was not with it. He was not a modern type of person. He didn't relate to the students very well. And one of the things, and there were other professors whom everyone loved because they essentially flattered the students. I found in the intervening 30 years that I have forgotten absolutely everything that the professors that I thought were really great and entertaining and terrific said. And what sticks in my mind and what has influenced me the most were the things that I heard from the professors whom everyone disliked and who were considered to be not worthy of paying attention to. This fellow named Frohawk said, there's something that I call Frohawk's Law, which is that all comedy becomes, at the end, either absurd or very sad. It becomes either absurdity or tragedy. But there's never been any such thing where comedy is sustained to the end. And I was just thinking how wonderful it would be, and it probably doesn't exist, if you could have a book or a movie or a play or anything that at the very, very end, you know, the last page, the last paragraph, would be as funny as anything that was in the book, where you could have a belly laugh. But then I wonder, where would you be? It would almost be like jumping off a cliff. There you are laughing, and then nothing. It's all silence. But anyway, this book, if it's funny, and I thought it was, and a lot of people have, at the end it veers into the root of great sadness and reflection, instead of the root of absurdity, which I don't like. You know, you see, in popular culture today, they take that route more than any other. The comedies and movies that are, for example, that are not quite comedies, always veer into absolute absurdity and loss of control at the end, instead of into the more reflective, tragic mode. It's a classical pattern. You see it in classical drama, too.
Well, I've always noticed in your books that by the end, the wildly various kinds of material and adventures are placed into a kind of perspective by which, once you discover what the subject of the book is, you discover that, for lack of an easier comparison, that there's been an inferno, a purgatory, and a paradiso, that relative virtues, that these books are frequently, pardon me, allegories mm-hmm. of morality.
What, pardon you? Thank you. Thank you very much. That's much appreciated. I don't. That's not hurtful or unpleasant for me to hear. I think it's great.
Well, it sounds academic, though, and I didn't want it to, you know.
Oh, that's all right. That's right.
I wanted to just jostle around. Listen, and be
I might
a
as well
pals.
Get the academic stuff here because I don't get it in academia.
Now, this is a man who, in the course of fleeing and escaping from the culture that has humiliated him, finds himself always not at home. He finds himself in Brazil. His mother had told him about what he took to be the Brazilians of the human spirit. But he finds himself in Brazil not comfortable with the casual sexuality, with the beach culture, or the prevalence of coffee. And he is a man destined not to be at home wherever he goes. You've described yourself that way, too.
That's correct. That's exactly. I feel much the same way. I've always been that way. For instance, in the 60s, I was under tremendous pressure all the time to use drugs because I would go to someone's house and everyone would be lighting up their drugs. I never once in my life used drugs. And like Oscar Progresso, I always used to say, I would say, and this is way back then, I would say, what you're doing is wrong. It's immoral and it's wrong. And they would say, they would laugh at me and say, why is it wrong? And I said, because it will bring death and destruction. And they thought I was nuts. And they would say, well, how is it going to bring death and destruction? It doesn't hurt us. And I would explain to them that their use of it creates the market and that the market would then expand and that it would include people who couldn't handle it as they might be able to and that these people would go off the rails and that eventually children and their parents would die and families would be destroyed and there'd be a lot of death and destruction because of this. And this was something they thought I was kind of a nut. And in a way, I am. And in a way, Oscar Progresso does the same thing. Of course, he does it with coffee because of his particular obsession with coffee. But I find myself in this position quite frequently, and I find myself uncomfortable with the way things are in general. Alienated, I suppose, is the word. Oh, I hate the word. I always thought I wasn't alienated because, see, everyone, most writers are supposed to be alienated. So I figured, well, I won't be alienated. Mm-hmm. And I firmly embraced not being alienated. But I guess I am, really, and I'll never be comfortable wherever I am. Actually, I wanted to once, I thought when we went to American Academy in Rome, I said to my wife, let's live in Venice. And she said, Venice? Why Venice? And I said, well, you know, from, among other things, you know, every day I can go out on the water in a single shell, and you can get all the newspapers. One of the horrors of my life is that I can't get the newspapers I want to read. I'm always struggling to get newspapers. I like to read lots of newspapers. I think it's impossible to read to have a good view of things if you only read one newspaper. I know it's impossible. So I read three or four newspapers. I like to read the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and foreign newspapers, Corriere della Sera, Le Monde, and British papers when I can get them. I can't get them, but in Venice you can get all these newspapers, most of them. So I said, there are newspapers there. The food is magnificent. It's beautiful, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, yes, but Venice, it's communist. This is like it's kryptonite. It would be kryptonite for you. And I said, exactly. I said, it would be perfect for me because it would be so completely different. I wouldn't have any responsibility. I'd be living in a world that had already completely turned. Everyone would be in control that I thought was completely beyond the pale. And so, therefore, I'd be completely cut off and I could concentrate on my work. So, in a way, I have to admit, there is a benefit to it. I mean, one minds those benefits. I don't think that I don't think that I am what I am solely because of my great saintly character. I think that actually it's in part a successful adaptation and a good strategy. Being this way, not being comfortable, not liking what you see, when you see it, you know, I turn on the television and what I see is absolutely disgusting and is horrible, somewhat like Oscar Progresso in that. And yet it stimulates in me the activity, which then brings me my living and more.
it's funny because I've sensed not so much alienation but strong, love-hate I don't mean ambivalence, because that's like indifference. Mm-hmm. But whenever you've spoken to me about your father, there's tremendous affection and respect, and at the same time, tremendous fear. You know, when you've described to me the way in which he would wake you up in the morning, mm-hmm. and how you swore that your little doves would not be woken.
And they have not ever been. Not that way, no. You know that since I was last here, I discovered all kinds of incredible things about my father. Astounding things that I think it was since 91. My father was always a great mystery to us all. He was very mysterious, and there are some things that we took for granted, which we shouldn't have, and which now, 11 years after his death, or even 10, 8, 9 years after his death, we began to think about him. We began to think, now, why was this? Why was it that he knew Churchill and was always running errands for Churchill? Why did he go to the White House, and why did he know Roosevelt? What was he doing that he knew Roosevelt? Why was he in Japan during the Korean War, three times? Why did he go to Spain? Why was he in Vienna during the Russian crisis? Why was he in Jamaica during the Cuban crisis? Turns out my father was an intelligence agent, and we didn't know that. But as the British records become unclassified 50 years later, it's come out that in fact the company that he worked for, London Films, which was Alex Korda's company, he was Alex Korda's first his protege, and then he more or less rose to an almost equal position. It was an arm of British intelligence, and there was a coordination with American intelligence. And this is what my father was doing. He had started back in the 20s when he went for his father to Central Asia, the Middle East, Central Asia, and then the new Soviet Union, to buy sheep innards for sausage casings, because his family was in the meat business. And when he got back, he was debriefed, and that began his connection with what was then, I suppose, military intelligence. And then it went on and on and on. He was a very close associate of Donovan, who founded the CIA. Donovan was his lawyer and his friend, and he was involved in all this. And it makes for the most wonderful detective story. And he was always the most secretive man. So this is a very large figure in my life who was mysterious and had immense capacities, the things he could do. Can I tell you something that he could do, which is just as an example? Let me tell you two things that he could do. One of them was that he could stand on a diving board with a cigar in his mouth, and then he would dive into the water and swim underwater and emerge at the other end of the pool with a lit cigar. Now, how do you do that? You know how he did that? He would, wouldn't touch it, his hands wouldn't go near his mouth. He would turn the cigar upside down and put it in his mouth, clenching it in his teeth so that it was still burning in his mouth, in the back, dive into the water, swim, and then do it with his lips. And I watched him closely when he did this finally. It was the most strange manipulation of the jaw, and there would the cigar be. But he'd do it fast, burning. That's one thing he could do. The other thing he could do was he had a photographic memory. And which is why they trained him, by the way, during the war. This we knew. This was not a secret. To be dropped behind German lines and to be captured deliberately and then to be taken and interrogated. And while he's being interrogated, he was trained to memorize his speed read upside down and backwards, upside down, the German documents that were on the desk, and commit them to memory for regurgitation perhaps years later, and retain all of them at every interrogation, and retain everything that he saw. And in view of this, he had a parlor game. He would say, what do you want me to... He said, name a street. And we lived in New York. And someone would say, 27th Street between 9th and 10th Avenue. And then he could tell you absolutely every detail on that street from the last time that he saw that street. He would say, well, there's a scroll work on the steps of the first brownstone, which is number 19. And I'll draw the scroll work for you. And he'd draw it. And he said, in the window of a little drugstore in the corner, the last time I passed there, there was the following. And he'd recite what was in the window. He had an extraordinary, absolute photographic memory. So there's two things he could do. So see, for me, my father was a legendary figure. I'll never get over him.
Well, it seems to me that the last three books, Memoir from Ant Proof Case, A Soldier of the Great War, and I'm putting Swan Lake there before, are all examinations of the relations between fathers and children, and in particular, the question of paternity.
That's quite so. And certainly they are Soldier of the Great War is about the handing off of the baton from one generation to another and the continuation of civilization and of love, really.
But so is Memoir from Man Proof Case, because the question is, how is this history to be transmitted? In this book, the child is in fact an illegitimate child. The man is in fact someone who has come to acknowledge that no one he has loved has actually loved him or been able to love him in that way. And yet there's still a desire to create a paternal transmission by the end of the book.
One of the things that he understands, and that I guess here we're getting awfully confessional, but what the hell, that I have understood is that even if you're not loved, even if you're not given a just time of it, that it's not only is it your responsibility to love, but also it's a great thing for you. It can make up for what you didn't have. And I've discovered this with my own children. I came from a very difficult family. My father was the healthy, wonderful part of my family. My mother is the difficult one. And I discovered that my background is more or less irrelevant, that I can retrieve it. I can make a new life, and I can make everything good that was by what I do now and the way I treat my children and how I am with my children. And this, I guess you're absolutely right. In Man Proof Case, his parents were taken from him in the most brutal fashion. And his life, he mentions, he says that the history of my love life was a history of unrequited love. All the women that he loved were either taken from him or left him deliberately. He was left in the end alone. But in the end, there's this child, Funyo, who is not even his own child in a further test. But it doesn't matter, because he loves the child, and the child is worthy of love. And that is how he salvages his life.
I've been speaking to Mark Helprin on the occasion of the publication of Memoir from Man Proof Case from Harkett Brace. Thank you for joining me again.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Mouse.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.